Listen to RN online or download from the Radio National website.
Hello, great to have your company for Life Matters this morning. Robbie Buck with you here on RN. Today you'll be hearing about a film festival with a difference. Unlike Cannes, Sundance or the Berlin Film Festivals, this one welcomes films created by 12-year-olds. It's the Little Big Shots Film Festival, and you'll be hearing from the director and meeting one of the movie makers. And yes, he's only 12. Also today, with news that Nelson Mandela is in a critical but stable condition, we'll take you to South Africa to hear the story of a university campus that's gone from racial segregation to integration, then back to segregation, and finally returned to integration. In some ways, it mirrors the challenges that the whole country is facing. That's all ahead. But first, if you're a working mother, have you calculated how much it costs you to go to work? It sounds counterintuitive, but after all those work-related expenses are paid for, and you include tax, just how much money do you take home? A business lobby group decided to do the sums, and unsurprisingly, one of the largest costs for working mothers is childcare. When they calculated the average pay and deducted the cost of childcare, a woman on an average wage is left with about $160 a week. Is it any wonder that many mothers conclude it's not worth their while to go back to work? The Australian Women Chamber of Commerce and Industry wants the cost of childcare to be front and centre in the coming election. And I'm joined today by CEO Yolanda Vega here on Life Matters. Good morning, Yolanda.
Good morning.
So let's take a little look at the numbers first of all.
Yes.
You say about $160 at the end of a working week once you take childcare out of it. What are the figures we're looking at here?
Certainly. So if we look at the average weekly wage net, that means after tax, of the average female in Australia, we're looking at $717 per week. If you have one child and you're taking that child to childcare every day, Monday to Friday, you're paying approximately $557 a week per child. So as the advertising campaign that we're running says, you work it out. Because if 717 take away 557 just on childcare, there's not a great deal left.
Okay, so is that just one child?
That's just one child.
So if you've got two kids, you're in the red?
Correct. You'd be in debt about $300 a week.
Obviously, you see this as a major disincentive for participation rates for working mothers. Do you have any sense of how it might change if it was more affordable? Is there a sliding scale, for example, of what the outcomes might be?
Well, there has been a lot of research into what would the outcomes be. And if you look at some of the data from the Grattan Institutes, they state that if 6% more women entered the workforce in Australia, we would have an increase of $25 billion in GDP alone. So these are quite significant numbers. What we have seen from the AWCCI research is that there's been an unprecedented number of women leaving the corporate environment to start up their own business. One of the reasons is because they can't afford or they can't access childcare. So imagine you're highly educated, you've been working for several years, you then decide to have your first or second child, and all of a sudden you find that the flexibility is not there, so you can't literally take care of your kids. Secondly, you can't access childcare because you can only put your kid into childcare between 5 p.m. and 8 a.m. in the morning 2 days a week. And then on top of that, if you actually go to work and pay for that, you're in the red. So the entire scenario is just impractical.
We've seen the response from a lot of companies, though, in the last decade or so, haven't we? There's been a real move and a change of mood in some of the higher echelons of a number of major international and Australian companies trying to address this. Have there been some effective cases that you've seen?
There are some effective cases, but at the end of the day, we have to remember that the corporate environment was built by men, primarily for men, and it was only at a much later time that women decided that they could and were allowed into the workforce. So the flexibility is still not there. There are changes and some very positive changes going on now with some of the bigger banks, and thanks to technology, for example, you can work from home, but nevertheless, the accessibility and the affordability issue remains the same.
So you think we're playing catch-up, essentially?
Oh, absolutely. Look, you know, we were celebrating in 2011 about how Australia finally got the parent scheme up and running. Cuba did it in the 1930s. I mean, we're a first developed economy, and we're still talking about childcare when it should be something that has been dealt with many, many years ago. It's just ludicrous.
Okay, so speaking about childcare in particular, the cost is one thing, and obviously it's very expensive in Australia, but accessibility is another major issue, isn't it? There's, particularly in some parts of Australia, even if you want to spend the money, getting a spot in childcare is also a major problem for some parents.
Absolutely. Some parents are waiting up to 3 to 4 years just to be able to access a space, and then that space may only be 2 days or 3 days a week for a small period of time. Mm. So the accessibility, and there's a whole bunch of issues around that, but the bottom line here is that when Mr. Rudd made his first speech as PM version 2, he said, "We must face the new challenges in productivity." If he is genuine, he will need to address childcare in order to address the productivity issues. Because if we've got 3.4 million women unable to work, that's a massive issue for the economy, for our communities, for women, for the corporates, for small business. It's an issue that is affecting everybody, regardless of whether you're an employee female or you're a self-employed woman.
We have seen moves, though, from the government side of things as well. There was the childcare rebate has been rolled out, and that makes it more affordable. Has that had an effect on productivity?
Very little, because $7,000 in childcare rebate per annum. Again, you work it out. If it's costing you over $1,000 a week for two children and you're only getting $7,000 back at the end of the year, it's hardly viable.
Okay, so what is your group suggesting might be some solutions to this? What would you like to see as an outcome?
We've got a variety of recommendations. Some of those is that we need to restructure the existing childcare system to include in-home childcare.
So this is a little like the French model.
Correct. So in Australia, we already have that precedent. The system already exists when we're talking about aged care, so the Grey Brigade, or you know, the people that are needing full-time attention. Those systems already in place. All we're saying is we can duplicate the exact same model.
Okay, so
for children.
Just give us an idea, Yolanda, of how the French model works and how it's different to Australia.
So the French model literally allows women to have in-home care. The flexibility of optional subsidies in-home care has helped French mothers re-enter the workforce. It in fact resulted in more than 80% of French women with one child and over 50% of women with three children were then able to go back to work. The issue here is that when we talk childcare, it's a big picture. You're talking about before and after school care. You're talking about care that is required when the child is ill and during school holidays. I don't know any parent that has a job that gives them 3 to 4 months holiday per year. And that's what children have off school. So we need to look at the system in a more holistic manner.
Who'd pay for a system like that, though? You're talking about a government-funded system?
I think it needs to be specifically looked at, and there are some organisations that are calling for the Productivity Commission to have a serious look at it.
Do we have a rough idea of how much it might cost?
Well, I spoke to the Minister for Childcare just recently, Kate Ellis, and she read our paper and she said, "Well, Yolanda, it would cost $2 billion and we don't have $2 billion. I don't know where she got that figure from. She hasn't been able to provide us with the specific figures, even though we've asked for them. $2 billion, at the end of the day, if we get just 6% of women back into the workforce, which equates to $25 billion, is hardly very much at all, especially considering you've also got the other issues whereby if women stay at home, they then don't have the capacity to earn. If they don't have the capacity to earn, they don't spend. If they don't spend, we have a reduction in the economy. If they don't have the ability to earn, they don't inject back into their communities, which means they don't invest in education, infrastructure, or health. And that is a long-term generational issue, not just a short-term issue today. We're talking about if women are not able to be productive today, it will affect many generations in the future.
Okay, just going back to this French model, which is one system that you're offering up as a possible solution. There are concerns, are there not, about being able to monitor the level of care if it's in an individual home, as opposed to regulated childcare centres where people are able to walk in and out and assess what level or standard of care is underway in the home. It's much harder to do that, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. And we're not suggesting that every house gets a camera, but we are suggesting that we use similar models to what we're using with the elderly. And also, for us, it would be a no-brainer to provide the childcare centres that exist today with the capacity to outsource some of these women. So if your child is sick for the next week, you can call the childcare centre where they normally go to and say, I need somebody to take care of that child at home for the next week. These women have already been scrutinised, they've already had the paperwork, they've been assessed, they've been in the industry. So some of the arguments from Kate Ellis are that if we do that, you know, these people might end up cleaning or cooking or whatever. Well, that's part of the childcare.
What's been, you've mentioned the government side of things, what's been the response across the political spectrum for these suggestions from your group?
The Coalition haven't really responded as yet, although Michaela Cash, the opposition spokesperson for the Status of Woman, recently said that if you want to talk seriously about improving workforce participation and productivity in this nation, we need root and branch reform of the childcare system. She says, I quote, not a tinkering at the edges. Australia needs a better childcare system that's less geared to 8 a.m. to 6 p.m. institutional care. So she's aware of the issues. They're all aware of the issues. But behind closed doors, many talk about the childcare issue as the poison chalice. And that may be the case from a political perspective, but from a human perspective, this is economic suicide for a nation to bring up barriers for women. It's crazy.
Do you think you're going to get much traction in the lead up to this election?
I don't know, but if we keep talking about it, maybe the media will ask more questions and get the politicians to give us some decent answers.
Thank you very much for joining us on Life Matters this morning.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Yolanda Vega, CEO of the Australian Women Chamber of Commerce and Industry. And we'll put a link to their homepage on our website if you'd like to have a little closer look at what they're suggesting. And of course, we'd like to hear from you about the proposal for subsidised in-home care. Do you think it's a good idea, or would you prefer more places in childcare centres? Is the cost of care the main issue, regardless of how it's provided? The growing gap between the government subsidy and childcare fees. You can leave a message on our website, on the Facebook, or of course on the listener line as well. You're listening to Life Matters.
Time to get physical again here on RN because the body sphere is back. In the weeks to come, a human history of crying.
In the sense of producing emotional tears, we are the only species.
What a philosopher thinks about running.
Running was the medium through which I explored the meaning of life.
And me and my new body part.
I put it on every morning like you'd put on a pair of shoes. I would get separation anxiety, I think, if someone took it away.
The Body Sphere, Sunday afternoons at 5 here on RN.
With Nelson Mandela in the news and in our thoughts, it's no wonder there's been a renewed interest in South Africa of late. The former president led his country to the abolition of apartheid after spending 27 years in prison. He's an inspiring figure both within his country and outside of it. But what is the state of his legacy today, 19 years after the end of racial segregation in South Africa? Eve Fairbanks moved to South Africa 4 years ago when she was just 26. At that time, she was a political reporter who had worked for the New Republic in Washington. She hadn't travelled outside of America, and for her, South Africa seemed like an exotic destination. What she found was somewhere not so different from home, but a place where nearly everyone, young, old, black, white, male and female, were going through major transformations. A place where racial tensions still exist, despite the end of apartheid. She joins me now on the line from South Africa for Life Matters. Good morning, Eve.
Good morning.
You've written an in-depth article that in some ways serves as a microcosm for the issues and tensions which are still at play in South Africa. Take us through it. It was based in a university there, and it's about integration and segregation, but perhaps not quite in the order that we might expect. Just give us a little sketch of what the article covers.
That's right. It's based at a university in the countryside, in the agricultural area of South Africa, and this university got into the South African news and the international news in a big way in 2008 when a video was released which depicted four white students, these are Afrikaner students, hazing their black janitors and sort of harassing their black staff. And when the media went to go check out what was going on at this university and how this could have happened, after the end of apartheid, after the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, after reconciliation in South Africa, they discovered that all of the dormitories and the social life on the campus of this university was totally segregated. In other words, there were white dormitories where only whites lived, black dormitories where only black students lived, black choirs, white choirs, separate black and white churches, totally, totally segregated, like it was still an informal apartheid. And this was strange to people because it was a number of years after the end of apartheid, and these were, in fact, young students in their late teens who had would have mostly grown up not under apartheid. So the idea that this was still happening was something of a mystery. And I spent a little bit longer at the university and discovered something that I found even more strange and provocative, which was that, in fact, right around 1994, which is when South Africa became a democracy and apartheid ended, the university had integrated quite successfully, and black and white students were living together, and everyone was very excited about this racial integration. And then, about 5 or 6 years later, it all came undone and became segregated again.
So in those early days for students of the university, it had historically been pretty much all white, and then they opened up the doors to more black students. But there was a willingness amongst the white students, was there not, for this integration to happen?
There was a willingness, as I say in my article, on their terms. In other words, if the black students who are coming in behave as they should, don't try to change the rules and manners of the institution, kind of go along with the white etiquette that had been in place for almost a century. It was quite an old historical Afrikaner university. And so that was the feeling at the beginning, but then, of course, that changed.
In many ways, I take it these are the same tensions that were playing out in all sorts of different institutions all over the country following on from apartheid. What happened as the years went on and as the numbers or the mix, if you like, changed within the university?
Well, as more black students started to come in and became 20%, 30%, 40% of the institution, they started to have a kind of group feeling and feel that they wanted to change the rules of the university, the language in which teaching was done, the particular rules and customs of the dormitories, in order to more fully reflect black culture, their culture. And when this started to come up and these requests started to come up, this was very, very disturbing to the white students because they really hadn't anticipated that integration would mean that their institutions would change substantially in how they were run and become less familiar to them, and not only change in the mix of the faces that you see there. And so then the white students began to feel much more negative about integration and start to reject it at that point. And that really is something that's played out nationally, which is that right after the end of apartheid, when Nelson Mandela became South Africa's first president, and there was this Truth and Reconciliation process in South Africa, a famous process, there really was the idea, and certainly internationally and overseas, that the South African story was kind of over and that the country would ride off into the sunset, and it had turned out so wonderfully, better than anyone could have imagined, with this black-white reconciliation, a real fairy tale. And but what started to happen is that after 5-10 years later, feelings began to become more negative again about integration, about how it was really going to work.
And on the university campus, Eve, those negative feelings came to a head on one fateful day. Just tell us what happened there.
Yeah, they did. One day in, I believe it was 1996, there was a big riot on the campus of the university in which a whole group of black students had reached the end of their rope about what they felt was white stubbornness and unwillingness to accede to their requests to change aspects of the university culture. And they all kind of went en masse with cricket bats and even guns, a few of them, in order to go and try to beat up the white students. And the white students were, I actually heard that this was going to happen and were waiting for them. And on a quad of the campus, you had these two flanks, a black flank and a white flank of students, male students, teenage students, ready to face off and do battle almost like in a war. And the amazing thing is that, you know, South Africa was at huge pains to prevent really a civil war, a real war, nationally, as apartheid drew to a close. And then there was this feeling, wow, we escaped it. And for the administrators on this campus who were witnessing this riot and this face-off of these two racial flanks, it was this extremely disconcerting moment because they said, oh my gosh, you know, we thought we had avoided that. And then now here it is, but in a different way than we would have imagined with young people.
Mm. And the response to that flashpoint was to resegregate, essentially.
It was. I mean, the university administration became very fearful that that particular night, nobody got killed. Some people were injured. But they said, you know, we can't afford to have actual gun battles and gun violence on this campus, so we have to just let people resegregate, because that's what the students said they wanted. We can't live together.
I'm joined by Eve Fairbanks this morning. She's a former political correspondent with The New Republic and is now based in South Africa, where she's currently writing a book. And we're just talking about this university. We should say where it is. It's not actually in one of the major cities, is it? It's more out into the country and perhaps in more conservative areas of South Africa that we're talking about here. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's true. Although similar dynamics do play out in Johannesburg and Cape Town, but it is in a historically Afrikaner stronghold.
Take us back to the video that we started with. This is the video that in so many ways peeled away the scab to reveal that wound that is so apparent in South Africa and the pain of the black and white segregation and the humiliation that was felt by so many people too, of these white students who were humiliating the black staff, the janitors at the university. At first glance, it seemed particularly simple and fairly barbaric, but there is a complexity to it, I take it. What is that complexity, and how did the video play out, not just on campus, but in South Africa in general?
Well, when the video was released onto YouTube, which my understanding is was sort of an accident, there's a rumor that one of the students who made the video, he dumped his girlfriend, and in bitterness, she uploaded it to YouTube. Nobody will exactly confirm that, but that seems to be what happened.
Right.
And when the video came out, then all of South Africa was very shocked. How could these white students be doing this to their black elders right now? But one of the interesting things that I later found out about this video is that it had actually been made 6 months earlier, and a lot of people had known about it on the campus of the university and not found it to be problematic. And indeed, the janitors who are in the video enjoyed the video. They watched it several times. They were happy about it. And they only realized later, they ultimately sued the white students in both civil and criminal court for sliming their reputation, for traumatizing them, etc. So later, their consciousness was sort of raised, they should be angry about this. But at the time, they were happy to be invited to be in a video that was filmed by white boys. They received a bottle of whiskey at the end, and their willing participation, to me, said so much about the state of race relations in South Africa that politically, on the top level, the country has changed. But on the day-to-day, these types of interactions, in other words, where a white boy would sort of film a mocking video of an older black person and then give them a gift afterwards to make up for it, would be really received as totally a normal type of a power relation.
Eve, the university was criticized at its core for not handling the change properly, the transformation that was required of the staff and students and for the new students wasn't handled in hindsight in a way that was as effective as it should be. And I take it this is a criticism that you could apply to a lot of different strata in South Africa, and understandably so.
Yeah, I think there was a feeling that right when integration started to go very well, right at the beginning, that, well, this is what we expected and this is great and that's great. And there was not a feeling that after the liberation struggle was over, after white rule ended formally, that there was still a battle to fight, that this change really had to be monitored, that it had to be very carefully sculpted by strong leadership, but rather that somehow it would just go on its own as it should. And it didn't. And you see a number of other institutions in South Africa, public institutions like the electricity utility, the train service, and so on, which have also fallen prey to this quite a kind of passive leadership, and not a realization, or only a realization too late, that there's still very, very hard work to be done after a moment of transformation, such as the end of apartheid, to preserve those gains and to really entrench them. And for me, that was a much more universal story. I think we often reach significant kind of battle points for social changes, and then those battles may be won, and we think, well, we've had a victory. The United States has just passed repealed the Defense of Marriage Act, which allows federal benefits to be extended to gay couples in the U.S., and it's a big, big, big moment there. And I think there is a little bit of a feeling, well, this was it, now we can relax, which is understandable. Now things are going to proceed forward, the work is done. But what I think this university story reveals is that change, positive social change, what we would maybe see as social progress, can very easily reverse itself after it seems to have reached a progressive point, and so it needs to really be monitored.
The university has changed its administration, and again, we are seeing reintegration on campus and a return to hopefully some of that goodwill that was expressed early on in the process. Is that being felt elsewhere in the country too, post-Mandela? Is there a sense that South Africa can afford to feel at least in some way optimistic?
I would say that South Africa is actually in a very pessimistic moment right now. There's been a lot of labor strikes over the past year on the mines, which make up about 20% of South Africa's GDP and really underpin the economy in a huge way. And over the course of last year, about half of the mine workers in South Africa at some point went on strike, which was really a huge a huge thing, feeling that they hadn't seen the rewards of freedom, that their wages haven't risen substantially, that free life for them as black mine laborers doesn't look as different from life under apartheid as they had anticipated it would. You also saw strikes in other sectors. There's been a lot of news stories out about corruption in the government and the sense that some elements of the government are using government to enrich their family members, to enrich themselves without trying to build the country or look out for the common weal of the country. So South Africa, over the past year, as Nelson Mandela has faded health-wise, it's really felt that worried about whether his positive legacy and the legacy of having built a country that's a beacon to so many other countries in terms of what it accomplished, that might be called into question, as there seem to be rifts now along class lines and so on, and social rifts in the country. As you say, the university, this university that I profiled, has become itself sort of a beacon within the country of a piece of positive news. It received in 2009 a new university president who was able to really bring something different to the university by virtue of being something of an outsider. He comes from a community called the Colored Community, which is a somewhat strange grouping in South Africa. It's South Africans of mixed race, but they were a separate group listed under apartheid, and they've long had a somewhat different culture. So he was, in a way, almost like a third party or an outsider on this campus, which had been very riven along black-white lines, and as this colored man. But he took a very autocratic line. I mean, he said, this university has to reintegrate. Here's how I'm going to do it. And he's been quite successful at reintegrating it and being a very powerful and at the same time warm leader. And I wish that I could say that South Africa nationally has leadership on that level. He's really the leader, people say, who is most like Nelson Mandela in their memory in terms of leading with a strong hand, but being very warm and welcoming, making overtures to white students who feel very threatened at the moment, as well as black students. But nationally, there's a feeling like there is a leadership void.
Well, we can only hope that that optimism spreads from the university campus to other parts of the country as well. Eve, thank you so much for sharing your insights with us here on Life Matters.
Thank you very much.
That was journalist Eve Fairbanks. She's a former political correspondent with The New Republic and is currently living in Johannesburg and completing a book about South Africa. She was speaking there about the University of the Free State in Bloemfontein and the ongoing challenges for South Africans. Of course, very much on the minds of South Africans and the world is the former president Nelson Mandela. It's reported that the 94-year-old remains in a critical but stable condition in hospital, and our thoughts are with his family. You're listening to Life Matters here on RN. Robbie Buck with you this morning, and stay with us. Coming up next, a film festival for kids and by kids.
It's the latest blockbuster at the National Gallery in Canberra. Turner from the Tate, The Making of a Master. The works of the 19th century English landscape artist. Now, your chance to see this for yourself on the house. RN is partnering with the National Gallery to offer three couples the chance to visit the exhibition. Just tell us, in 50 words or less, what Australian scene you would have liked Turner to paint and why. All the details on the RN homepage. That's Turner from the Tate.
If you're a parent of a young child, or even an adult who likes to think of themselves as permanently young, this opening theme is probably pretty familiar to you. Children's movies these days are big business. Some of the highest earning children's flicks rake in hundreds of millions of dollars. The Lion King made $423 million. Toy Story 3 made $415 million, and the list goes on. But where do you go if you want to watch something a little bit different? An animation or children's film that wasn't produced by one of the major companies. Little Big Shots is an international film festival for kids that aims to get the best children's movies from all corners of the globe. Joining me this morning is Festival Director Ben Layden and one of the directors featured in this year's festival, Ben McCarthy. Welcome to both of you to Life Matters.
Hi, Robbie.
Ben Layden, if I can start with you. Little Big Shots was founded back in 2004. What was the motivation for it? Why the need for a festival of children's films?
Well, it's quite simple, really. The founder of the festival, Nick Place, basically wanted to show some of the best films from around the world, short films for kids, to his kids. He had a couple of young children, and he'd been travelling a lot and had attended a couple of festivals around the world, and then realised that there was really no festival directed solely at children in Australia, so he thought he'd establish one.
Are there many precedents outside of Australia for these sorts of festivals?
Indeed, there are some very big events in Europe and in America. Our first, I suppose, stopping off point really was Chicago. They have a massive film festival for children over there, and I attend that festival every year. Although there are certainly a couple of the European festivals which have been sneaking up on Chicago.
So what are the principles, if you like, the selection process for what you choose for Little Big Shots?
When we set up the festival here, we have a couple of criteria that have become part of the Little Big Shots tradition. And I suppose the first thing is that we like to actually program films by young people in all of our packages. So we always make a place in each and every screening for at least one film made by a child. Secondarily to that, we're looking for a kind of mix, and of course it's really important that we make space for Australian independent cinema in the package mix. But I mean, aside from that, I guess my overriding curatorial approach to making the packages, I'm looking for something a bit quirky.
Mm. Well, with that in mind, we have one of your directors whose film is appearing in this year's Little Big Shots. And I guess it's fair to say that he comes in at the slightly younger end of the spectrum when it comes to movie directors. Ben McCarthy, welcome to Life Matters. How old are you?
12.
So pretty old. How long have you been making films for?
Well, ever since I was 8.
Right, so that's years, really.
Yes.
And this is not the first film that you've had in this festival, is it?
No.
What was the first one?
Oh, it's called Lightbulb.
Okay. And what sort of film was that?
It was a claymation.
Mm-hmm. This year, you've got a very different film. In fact, a film that some people may be familiar with because it's been winning all sorts of awards. You won Trop Junior earlier this year, and it's just, what is it, this week, picked up a big award in New York. Tell us about Bumper.
Well, Bumper is about a frog that can't jump, and his frog family actually has a lot more to do with jumping because his family, well, they do a lot of jumping. Their parents, they make trampolines and they sell trampolines.
Okay, so there's a lot of jumping going on in that frog family.
Very lot of jumping.
Which means if a frog comes along that can't jump, what happens?
It's chaos.
So it's really the story about trying to find your place in the world, isn't it, Bumper?
Yes.
That if you don't necessarily fit in exactly with what's expected, it's about finding your own qualities in lots of ways. Where did the idea for Bumper come from?
I live in Brooklyn, and there's
this is Brooklyn in Australia, we should mention,
yes,
too, isn't it?
In Australia.
Yeah.
And there's the Brooklyn Dam, and near the dam is where all frogs and tadpoles swim around, and I just wanted to make a film about it.
About tadpoles.
And frogs.
And frogs, of course. And good old Bumper, he tries out a few different sports, doesn't he, that
yes.
don't quite work for them. What, like what?
He tries to do breaststroke.
No, and he's no good at that, is he?
No.
No, what's the other one that he thinks about?
He thinks about shot put,
mm.
and he can't even pick it up.
No, that's a bit of a problem with shot put if you can't pick it up.
Yeah.
And there's even a little bit of thought about a winter sport.
Oh, yes. I forgot what it's called.
Aerial skiing.
Yeah, aerial skiing.
Mm. But he doesn't get into that. But
no.
The great thing about this, and it's a story of redemption, is Bumper, and some of the great films in history are about stories of finding your place in the world and of redemption. He does find something that he eventually is very good at, doesn't he?
Yes.
What is it?
Pole vaulting.
Why? How did you come up with the idea of pole vaulting being your frog's favourite skill?
I'm not sure. I just like pole vaulting.
Ben Layden, if I can come back to you as festival director, what attracted you to young Ben's film?
Well, I think there's no doubt that Ben has an enormous amount of talent, and at such a young age, we just were taken aback by the skill and also the progression so quickly in his filmmaking. To see where he's gone in a year, I think, is just quite extraordinary. And it's very clear. There's obviously a high level of skill which he puts into the process. And most importantly, the story is just really cool.
What's the response from kids who are coming along to Little Big Shots as a film festival, and particularly seeing obviously highly well-produced films, but they're still produced by much younger directors? And when you stack it up against a powerhouse, you know, Hollywood movie house like Disney, for example, are they open to the idea of seeing different production styles and different approaches to film?
That's the amazing thing, really. I guess that obviously the parents who come along have a slightly more coded approach to the way they're viewing the films, but kids have a really open appreciation for the material, and they come along, and if they like the film, they let you know about it right there and then in the cinema.
In what
and
way?
Well, I mean, they'll just scream out and say, yeah, that's cool, that rocks. And then, of course, I mean, I think the most wonderful thing is that they're not only seeing those high-end, high production value films, which we do put into the program, but then when they see a film made by a young person, they look at it and then they come away with just that thought in their head, I could do that. And that's really what Little Big Shots is about. It's not only about showing really great films, it's about trying to get kids to start about thinking creatively and hopefully submitting films to us next year.
So you've got about 80 films in this year's schedule, is that right?
That's right, yep.
And how many of those would be made by younger filmmakers?
Well, this year, I suppose, to coin a phrase, it's been a bumper year for kids' films. We had 30 films made this year by kids, so which is a record year, basically, for child-made films in the festival.
Ben McCarthy, how did you get into filmmaking? You were only 8.
Yes.
What was it that drew you towards wanting to make films?
When I was 8, I remember watching Wallace and Gromit, and I just liked how they did everything from the camera angles to the clay making, and I just wanted to do it.
Are you hearing this a lot, Ben Layden? Is there a sense that now that this technology is available, you know, to pretty much anybody really, that the opportunity for kids to get involved in this kind of creative process is much greater than it ever was in the past?
Absolutely. And I think that's why you're really seeing a lot of the other film festivals that are directed purely at young filmmakers springing up around the country and having great success. But I suppose to balance against that, I mean, one of the really interesting things is that young people like Ben are going back to traditional techniques as well to make their films
like claymation.
Indeed. I mean, we get a lot of submissions which are using computer animation or high-end editing programs, but also the claymation aspect is really great for kids because they can see all the parts of the films as they put it together, and certainly, you know, not every young person is able to put it together as well as Ben, but really, I think it sort of goes both ways, that you have the sort of new techniques, but then also looking back towards the sort of more traditional aspect.
So what are your thoughts about the future with this, as you said, a bumper crop of young filmmakers who are coming up with really engaging, exciting and quite diverse films? Are we going to see a renaissance in Australian filmmaking in the years to come from all this interest?
Well, you'd certainly hope that was going to happen. I mean, it's obviously very difficult, still very difficult, and I'm sure it will continue to be very difficult for Australian filmmakers to get their work out there. But with the availability of technology, people are starting younger and younger, and that can only be for the good.
What about you, young Ben? Do you have a lot of friends who have been inspired by what you've done, or have you met other filmmakers around your age who are interested in doing similar things?
Yes.
And what do you talk to them about?
The best parts about movie making.
Okay, what are they?
Well, the best parts about movie making is to grab the audience's attention.
Mm-hmm. And how do you do that?
Either jokes or good story.
So how long do you work on your script, for example? You said it took 6 months for Bumper, this film, which is close to 5 minutes, isn't it? Which is a long time for claymation. There's a lot of work that's gone into it. How long do you spend on coming up with the script and the idea for your story?
Well, I think it takes about a week to write the whole script. But as we go through it, we come up with better ideas and we just keep modifying the script.
Well, Bumper has done very well for you, but you're not going to be resting on your laurels. You're in the middle of a new film, is that right?
Yes.
Tell us about that.
Well, it's about two mischievous mice that try to steal biscuits.
Aha. And what do they get up to?
They try to steal biscuits, and the person who lives in the house, he tries to kill them all. There's only two mice, though.
Right.
And they put down traps, and they try adventurous ways to take all the cheese.
And I understand you've been able to recruit some of your other family members into this film. Is it true that there might be somebody in the family who has to spend quite a number of hours holding a mouse via a string with just a little bit of help from the rest of the family?
Yes.
Who's that?
Well, the person who does a string that when the mice comes down, that was done by my dad.
Right, and how long did he have to hold the string for?
It was up there for about 2 hours.
I hope he gets a credit at the end of this.
Yeah.
Ben Layden, just coming back to you, as a director of a festival like this, do you think it's going to have an effect on what we see in more, dare we say, conventional outlets for children's television and cable television, etc.? Are we going to see perhaps more diversity going on in what's being screened in those areas?
Well, I certainly think that could be one of the aspects. There's a slight crossover that happens where, as a festival like ours increases its profile, we see more films coming from independent sources, but also the larger players start to get interested in us as being a platform for getting their work out there. So it's a really curious kind of mix where you see Academy Award-winning films, the studios involved with them approach us and say, well, we've heard a lot about Little Big Shots. Can we get our film in there? And then, of course, the trick then is to get the balance right between the higher end of town and the really innovative voices like Young Ben.
Mm. Speaking of which, you said Wallace and Gromit was one of the inspirations for you, which is that fantastic Aardman animation. But what about some of the other styles of animation, the other kids' movies that you really like? I mentioned Toy Story 3 before and The Lion King, those sorts of films. Are they the sort of things that you really like and would like to end up perhaps taking a part in?
Yes.
What are some of your favourites?
I do like Toy Story 3.
Mm.
It was quite funny.
Yeah, that was good. Have you seen all three?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And what about some of the other animated films for kids? What else do you like?
There was this one, and it was for kids, but it had a lot of jokes in it. It was called Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs.
Ah, yes. I recall that one. And that's one of your favourites as well, isn't
it? Yes.
Yeah. Just finally, Ben Layden, in terms of having some of the Australian filmmakers like Ben that we've been chatting to today, having some of their work exposed outside of Little Big Shots, are there avenues after you've chosen it for your film festival for them to end up elsewhere, and particularly internationally? I guess there would be a great deal of interest in being able to see young Australian filmmakers being represented elsewhere. Ben here, who has just picked up an award in New York, of course, is a perfect example of that. But is there much of that going on?
Well, absolutely. I mean, there's a really strong circuit of children's film festivals around the world. And of course, once you get your film screened in one festival, then it becomes a great deal easier then to get it programmed into another one. It is very competitive, and clearly that's never going to change, really. But I think the proof's in the pudding, really. If you can get that film made and it's got a strong idea, then there really is boundless opportunities for young people and independent filmmakers to get their films out there.
So is Bumper, the, you know, the story of the frog that was inspired by the dam near Brooklyn in New South Wales, is that story going to be seen by eyes across the globe?
I'm sure. As you mentioned, Ben's just picked up the award in New York, and I've got no doubt that Ben's work, this film Bumper, and of course his subsequent films are going to be getting out there across screens. And I wish him and of course all his family all the best, because it's a bit of a team effort, I think, when it comes to young filmmakers. They need a lot of support and a lot of encouragement.
It sounds like that is the case. Ben McCarthy, you're an award-winning film director at the age of 12. Where would you like to be when you're a really old man at 22 in 10 years' time? What would you like to be doing?
Probably making movies at Aardman.
Sounds like you might have a very good chance. To both of you, thank you very much for joining us.
No problem, Robin.
That was 12-year-old film director Ben McCarthy, winner of Tropfest Junior, and Ben Layden, the festival director of the Little Big Shots International Film Festival for Kids. The Little Big Shots Festival is currently travelling around the country. You can find a link to the details at our website, abc.net.au/radionational, and just look for Life Matters. And while you're there, why don't you have a little look at Ben McCarthy's award-winning film Bumper, a short claymation film about a frog that can't jump, which is, let's face it, a pretty big issue for a frog. Robbie Buck with you on Life Matters here on RN, filling in for Natasha Mitchell. Just until the end of the week, your usual host will be back on Monday, fear not. But heading up towards the top of the hour and a little bit of time for some feedback. Of course, we always love to hear from you about any of the stories that you hear on Life Matters, and plenty of ways to get in touch. You can join us via Twitter. Our handle is at RN Life Matters. On our Facebook page, you can leave a comment on our website. And of course, you can ring the Life Matters listener line. That number is 02-833-1430. We love to hear from you regardless of how you get in touch. Some lovely responses to yesterday's program as part of NAIDOC Week. We had a special co-hosting broadcast. You may recall the wonderful Layla Gurawiwi was my co-host for the entire hour yesterday. And there's been a terrific response again on Facebook and on the website. Here's an email that we had from Kath about yesterday's program. I've been listening to Radio National for years and have never felt compelled to email until today. Today's show was fantastic and made me want more Indigenous co-hosting on Life Matters. I learnt a lot. It was a real sharing of roles, and it was fun. This is what we need in Australia, to hear more about the lives, challenges and successes of Indigenous Australians. I would strongly recommend you make this a weekly, fortnightly or a monthly event. Thank you very much for that, Kath. Another response that we had going back to our conversation earlier in the week regarding the question, are men too stressed for sex? We had a response on the website from Space who wrote, I did a PhD on men and the men's movement. One of the areas I examined is men's experience of isolation. One of the findings I made from interviewing leaders in the men's movement and literature search is that intimacy and sexuality are closely linked. Women have intimacy with many other people, especially other women. Men have intimacy with the person they have sex with. Hence, sexuality and intimacy are very closely linked for them. So in some ways, men seek sex in order to enhance personal intimacy, which they lack in their lives with other people, especially with men. Mateship is a fun social connection between men, but not a sharing of intimacy. Connection with other women stops because of relationship protocols, so that within 1 to 2 years of long-term relationships, men lose connection with all women other than family members. So when there is a relationship breakup, men are suffering and do not recover as well as women unless they find another woman very quickly. Thanks for your comments as well, Space. And again, both that conversation with Layla yesterday and also that interview with Elaine George, you can find on the Life Matters website. There's a link to the video of those two conversations as well. And if you haven't checked them out, you're more than welcome to do so. News coming up in just a moment's time, and then after that we'll be joined by Michael Cathcart for Books and Arts Daily. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning, Robbie.
What have you got for us this morning?
Well, 200 of our most famous pictures and other works of art too, photos and video art, are all heading off to London. And I mean, these are really famous paintings, including Nolan's most famous image of Ned Kelly, Fred McCubbin's The Pioneer, Grace Crossington Smith's The Bridge. I mean, just really famous stuff. It's all being put on a plane, all going to London.
What are they doing with it?
They're going to put it up on the wall.
Good.
So there's a huge exhibition on at the Royal Academy of Arts, 200 works of landscape. Paintings.
I hope they appreciate it.
I hope they do. I hope they like what we've sent.
That's coming up, and a little bit of NAIDOC week as well. You'll be sharing some of the music of the Stiff Gins.
We certainly will. That's coming up too.
Thanks very much, Michael. News is up next. I'll join you tomorrow. We'll be talking to somebody who's done a whole year without buying plastic. Could you do that?
It's the announcement many car industry observers have long been expecting. After losses of about $600 million over the last 5 years, Ford says it can no longer afford to make cars in Australia.
American, Japanese and even British and European car companies once made cars in Australia. Now it's an industry on life support. Find out what's gone wrong with making cars in Australia on Rear Vision. Download or stream this program from the Radio National website.